Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art Beats and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
For decades, milk has been fueling women marathon runners as the OG performance drink. And in the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk, Abby Ayers takes us on a journey of self-discovery as she meets several groups of empowered women runners to find out what drives them, what fuels them, and what pushes them to go the distance. And in the process, she learns that she too can be a distance runner. You can watch the series at runningsucktheseries.com and register for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon at everywomansmarathon.com.
Hello, welcome to the Longform Podcast. I'm Max Sinsky. I'm here with my co-hosts, Aaron Lammer, Evan Ratliff. Gentlemen, hello.
Hey.
Hello, Max Linsky, host of 70 Over 70, another podcast. Aaron Lammer, host of Exit Scam, another podcast. I feel like you guys should say that every time.
Evan, where is your podcast?
I don't have a podcast. I'm just an independent journalist out here doing my own thing.
I'll tell you, I met someone who listens to my new podcast, Exit Scam, who was a fan of The Mastermind. That's a book by Evan Ratliff.
Hey, all right, crossover.
It's still available. Hey, is it available on paperback?
It is indeed available in paperback.
I don't think we've ever even mentioned on the show that the price of Mastermind has gone down now. If you were holding out on the hardcover run, this time is for you. So we've all got free to affordable projects that you can support as listeners to the show. Please subscribe to 70 Over 70. That's Max's show. Please subscribe to Exit Scam. That's my show. And please go buy a copy of The Mastermind. Okay, we've taken care of that. Who's on the show this week?
Man, you are incredible slinging this stuff. And we've got another independent journalist with a thing to sling this week on the show. It's Rose Eveleth, who is the host of the Flash Forward podcast, which is part of a network of podcasts that Rose herself has started. She has a book out. It's called Flash Forward, obviously, an illustrated guide to possible and not so possible tomorrows. The format of Flash Forward is that Rose takes an idea, something that will happen in the future, and then investigates it and sees how it might play out and also how that might impact our choices in the moment. The book takes a bunch of those ideas and sort of reimagines them. She collaborated with artists who did sort of graphic treatments of those ideas, and then she wrote essays about them. It's all super, super fascinating, and she's really, really good at it. So we talked about how she does it, but also like why she does it, because she does her work in a way that feels quite unique to me. It's completely independent. She does it on her own. She runs the business side and the content. And that was after a bunch of full-time gigs at very established places that, I mean, I don't know. I'll let her tell it. But there's a reason that she's doing this stuff independently now. And it was a total pleasure to talk to her. I also think this is a particularly good episode if you are a freelancer, because Rose has real strong thoughts on how to do that. And she has like Google Docs that she will share with you that explain it all.
Wow. Wow. Hey, if you're going to do anything independently, it's going to need an email newsletter. That's how you're going to corral all the people who care about what you're doing. And you can get one with MailChimp. In fact, they make the best ones. I really recommend you check them out. Thanks to MailChimp.
And now here's Max with Rose Eveleth.
Hey, Rose. Thanks.
Hi.
Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. I'm very excited. Long time, first time.
Yeah, long time, first time here too. I'm a fan of your stuff. You're here now because you've put out a book, but I'd like to go back if we can before we talk about the book. Is that okay?
A classic podcasting move. Before we can understand where we are today, we have to go back.
I mean, that's literally how you start most of your episodes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I do want to talk to you about your future, Rose.
Okay.
But first, to get there, I think we need to understand where you've been.
Yeah. I've actually banned myself from using that phrase in the podcast, like starting last year. I was like, I cannot say that phrase again. It's like too cliche for the show now.
Here's the thing that I'm genuinely curious about. You are, at least from like my vantage point, a truly independent journalist who is straddling a bunch of different lines. You're running a podcast network, you're hosting a show, you're writing books, you're cutting deals, you're doing it all. And I wonder where that like spirit comes from, do you think?
Well, it all goes back to when I was a child, which actually is, I think, sort of true. I tell the story sort of in a joking way, but I also think that it potentially does explain a lot, which is that I, as a kid, never learned to ride a bicycle. And as an adult, I was like, I would like to learn to ride a bicycle. And so I taught myself or whatever. And then I was talking to my parents and I was like, wait a minute, like, why didn't you ever teach me how to ride a bicycle? Right. Like, that seems like the kind of thing you teach a child. And they were like, oh, you just never asked. If you had asked, we would have taught you. And I was like, I feel like that's your job as parents to like predict these kinds of things. But like, it's totally true. And that's like kind of how they are, how they were. And I like asked to be scuba certified at 12 because I thought I would be the next like Jacques Cousteau. Turns out finding someone who will certify a 12-year-old in New Jersey is hard. And so we went to like these former Marines who had this like scuba school. And so I like got certified at 12. And like that was very much the way they are, is like if you ask for it, they'll help you figure it out and you can do it. But like you kind of got to ask for it. And so I feel like that's just sort of like always been my thing of just like going after it.
Well, yeah, but here's my question. Like New Jersey,
yeah,
a place I'm somewhat familiar with. Very heavy bicycle culture.
Yeah.
See a lot of kids on bikes in New Jersey.
Yeah. I had friends who learned how to ride bikes.
I assume most of them. Yeah. You're walking around New Jersey. All your friends are riding bikes. It doesn't occur to you to be like, I'd like to get on a bike. The thought that 12-year-old Rose has is scuba diving.
Yeah. Yeah. I was like, you know what? Let's try the weird thing, which also I feel like maybe sums up a lot.
So that is where you like, where you trace that instinct from is like, just trying to like do the thing on your own rather than doing the thing that everyone is doing?
Yeah, I think so. I was always like the weird kid. My parents are very strange. My dad hiked the Appalachian Trail by himself. He's like that kind of guy. My mom is also like that. So I never quite felt like I fit in, even in grad school. I went to grad school for journalism, but I didn't have any experience in journalism. I had like gone to school for science. I thought I'd be a scientist. And actually, I tease the head of that program now at NYU, which is the Science, Health, and Environmental Reporting program, Dan. I always tease him because I actually did not get in. I was waitlisted. And I joke with him about it because he was like, yeah, your application was like bizarre because you had no experience. And I wrote this like weird speculative fiction piece to like apply to journalism school. And he was like, who is this person? And so I did not get in. I actually got in off the waitlist sort of by chance, which is very rare. The program is only 15 people. And most of the time, everyone just says yes when they get in. So like the chances of getting it off the wait list are usually pretty low. And I just happened to get lucky. So yeah, I've like always kind of been like, oh, that seems fun. I'll try that. Why not? You know, like, let's do it.
I love the idea that they like finally had a slot open up and they were like, all right, who's on the wait list? Oh, there's that speculative fiction kid.
Weird lady. Yeah, like, what is up with her? Yeah.
That would throw an interesting element into the cohort.
Yeah, right. Really, I was like the wild card in like the reality TV show where they like throw in the wild card potentially villain character. Like that was me in grad school.
What was your experience in grad school? Was it worthwhile for you?
It was great. I mean, like I didn't know anything about journalism. Like I didn't know what a lead was. I had no idea how to write a story. Like I knew nothing. And so it was—
Why'd you want to do it?
I knew I didn't want to do science because I had actually gotten very lucky and was able to work in a lab while I was an undergrad and kind of like get a sense for like what that would actually be like as a job. And I sort of was like, oh, I don't actually want to be doing this. part of the problem was I couldn't focus on any one specific thing. And like, if you want to go get a PhD and become a scientist, you do kind of have to like pick a field to be working in. And I had like applied to grad school in like four very different fields, like marine biology. I got very interested in orchid bees at one point. So I was like, maybe I'll go do that. And like, I had this very kind advisor who was my boss in the lab who was like, you know, if you can't even figure out like which field of biology you're interested in, like maybe you shouldn't be going to grad school for it. And they actually had a student who had gone to a different science journalism graduate program. I think it was the MIT one. And it had never occurred to me that that was like a thing you could do, would be like write about science as opposed to do the science. And so it just seemed like the right combination. I loved writing and I really liked science, but I didn't want to do science. And so it seemed like an obvious thing to try. And I was really late to apply. I think I like learned about the program a couple weeks before the deadline. And so I just like did that's why for the reason I like submitted weird fiction, because I didn't have anything to submit. So yeah, it was just like, it seemed like a good combination of the stuff that I was interested in. But when I got there, I was like, I have no idea what I'm doing. Just truly no idea. So it was great. I learned a ton.
Did that feeling freak you out, or was it exciting?
It was exciting. It was exciting. Even when I didn't know what I was doing, like we were reading stuff that I was like, oh yeah, it would be really cool to write this kind of thing. Like I didn't have a ton of exposure to science publications, right? Like my parents did not listen to NPR. Like that was not on in our house. We were a Rush Limbaugh, Dr. Laura, Opie and Anthony, horrible shock jock stuff on the radio in our house.
Your dad was a hike the Appalachian Trail by himself while listening to Rush Limbaugh kind of person?
Oh yeah.
That is there's not a lot of crossover in that Venn diagram.
Yeah, they're weird people. I love them, but they are weird people. I will say they no longer listen to Rush Limbaugh. They have swung pretty clearly leftwards. But yeah, growing up, it was like that. I didn't think of like being on the radio as a thing that I would want to do.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't like I went in like all of my, not all, but many of my, you know, classmates had like read The New Yorker, and like I didn't even know what The New Yorker was, you know. So like that kind of stuff, it was being exposed to a whole kind of thing that I didn't even know existed, and I was like, oh yeah, this is really cool.
Can we just go back to arriving there?
Yeah,
because when I hear you talk about showing up in a grad school program, having gotten in with a little bit of speculative fiction and realizing like, oh, I actually don't know anything about this, that's like some sort of recurring nightmare for me. Like I never finished my math class. I never graduated from college or whatever, you know? But you were cool with that?
So I was never a great student. So like the idea of failing a class never really scared me, because I was like, yeah, I've been there, done that. Don't really care. So for me, it was just more exciting that I was learning stuff, and like it was really satisfying to do. And I think it's true for everyone there, even if you have a little bit of experience. And some people did come in having like worked for their college newspaper or whatever. But even if you have that experience, they really do like throw you in the deep end at the very beginning. Like you are writing stories, interviewing people like from the get-go. And so I wasn't alone in that feeling. There were other people there who also were kind of like, whoa, like what's happening here? And so in some ways there was that helped. I didn't feel like I was the only one who was like, whoa, like what are we doing? But I don't know, I like that feeling. I like leaning into something where, you know, when you find a story idea and you're like, ooh, I don't know anything about this, and then you lose 19 hours to like reading stuff and like, you know, whatever. That feeling, that's my like drug of choice in many ways, is like finding those places where you're like, oh shit, I did not know that this was even a thing, and now I'm gonna like get to really like dig into it for an extended period of time.
And is that, I mean, I want to talk about your journalism and your work and the show and the book, but part of the reason I was so excited to talk to you is that you have engaged like so fully with the business side of what you're doing too. And do you bring the same energy to that part of it as well? Like, is that exciting and interesting, or is that like a necessary evil to do the stuff you want to do?
I think it's a little bit of both. I don't love it. I don't get that same kind of like, ooh, I'm going to figure out how podcast analytics work. Like, this will be fun. You know, like, I don't feel that. But I do actually try to trick myself a little bit into that zone to be able to do some of this stuff. Because, like, the downside of being like this is that when that feeling isn't there, it can be very hard for me to do the thing that needs to get done.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, for me, for a lot of the business stuff, I will try and, like, almost gamify it for myself in that way to be like, okay, what is the fun, cool thing I can try with this? So like for ads, you know, who likes writing and reading advertisements? Not that many people probably. And so I like came up with a little thing to be like, okay, well, maybe what I'll do for every ad is I'll like put in a secret reference so that if listeners get that reference, I send them a sticker. And so like I like have a little game where I'm like trying to make it fun for myself, because yeah, otherwise I just won't do it.
For the record, I love reading ads, and the ones you're about to hear will be delivered with gusto and vigor.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So
Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Cult Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual paths while also revealing their distinct roles within art, beats, and lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu.
Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Vox Creative.
This is advertiser content from 26.2 Team Milk and their new docuseries, Running Sucks.
Is running the worst?
Yeah.
Do you love it? Do you hate it?
I hate it so much. I hate it so freaking much.
That you're a real runner now!
I hate it.
I'm Abby Ayers, a 37-year-old mom from Utah who found herself running across the Manhattan Bridge in my first race ever.
Running Sucks celebrates women who run and the running communities that carry them across the finish line.
Running helped me in so many ways postpartum.
It really is about taking my power back and proving myself wrong.
For every person like you, I'm telling you, you belong, and I'm telling you, you can do it.
I never thought the words would leave my mouth, but yes, I'm planning on running a marathon. I can't even say it without laughing, because, like, who would have thought?
Watch Running Sucks at runningsucktheseries.com and learn more about how Team Milk is helping women runners across the country conquer their next course.
So you get out of J school. You have figured out what a lead is. And what comes next? What kind of work were you trying to do?
I went right into freelancing. And that was, like, weird at the time. I think now there's more of a sense that, like, freelancing is a choice that you make as opposed to a thing that happens to you if you can't get a job. But I just knew that there wasn't a job that let me do all the stuff that I wanted to do. And that included things like audio, podcasts, radio stuff. I was at the time, like, learning how to do animation, and so I was doing little animations for, like, Scientific American and stuff, because literally at a meeting someone was like, we need an animation, but that will be expensive. And I was like, I can do it. I did not know how to do it. And so I learned how to do it so that I could file this thing. I was like, I'm an intern. What's the worst that could happen? They fire me? Like, oh, well, I'm not being paid anyway. Like, you know. And so I figured out how to do animation. So I was working on that. I was learning how to, like, code stuff. So doing just, like, basic infographic, like, coding stuff for different places. And that was at the time, too, where, like, if you knew very basic JavaScript and CSS, it was like magic to a lot of publications, and they would just, like, pay you money to do stuff. So yeah, so it was sort of a weird time in journalism where you could kind of, like, do a lot of different stuff and nobody really knew what was going on.
What, like, years are we talking about?
That was, like, 2010, 2011.
So just, like, post-recession times.
Yeah, yeah. And, like, it was right when a lot of publications, especially on the science side, were finally taking down the wall between, like, print and online. And so there was a lot of, like, shuffling. There were a lot of people on the online side who were excited to have more hands, and people on the print side who were like, oh God, I don't want to have to learn how to, like, use a CMS ever. And so, like, there was just a lot, I think, of space to be that kind of, like, weird person who dabbles in a lot of different projects, and everyone was, like, kind of trying a lot of different stuff. I think it's harder now probably to do that, like, weird stuff that I was doing at the time. But yeah, so I just went right into freelancing. I was like, let's see if I can, and if, like, I can't make it work, I can figure out something else. I don't know.
And what were your, like, what were your ambitions then? Like, where did you want to be? What kind of work did you want to be doing? Like, I totally understand that impulse of just being like, oh, I know animations in the, you know, in the meeting when you're the intern. But, like, what did you want then for your work?
I don't know that I knew very clearly. I knew that I, like, enjoyed doing a lot of different things. And I enjoyed sort of, like, the problem solving aspect of that kind of thing, where it's like, what is the best way to tell this story? Is it going to be an animation, or is it going to be an infographic, or is it going to be an audio story? And, like, having the flexibility to make that choice aesthetically was really exciting. I think I probably thought, ooh, maybe I will eventually get a job at Radiolab or something like that, like sort of doing that stuff. But I mean, when you first start freelancing, your main goal is just like find work anywhere possible, right? And so you're just like trying to keep the lights on in a lot of ways. So I don't know that I had like super long-term goals at the time because I was just trying to like make it work. But I think, I don't know, my goal is always to just like have fun, which just sounds like it was incredibly privileged. It also sounds like kind of like a woo-woo, like, oh, just have fun and it'll all work out. But that is my goal in life. So that's what I'm generally driven by. And it was true at the time. I was like, that sounds fun. I'll try that.
I mean, what I hear you saying is you like genuinely follow your interests.
Yeah.
It doesn't always work out for people.
It doesn't always work out for me.
Well, what are sometimes it hasn't worked out for you? Because from like the sidelines, it seems like it's worked out. So like, when are the times where following your gut or looking for the thing that seemed fun didn't work?
Yeah, I mean, it's so easy in hindsight to be like, and yes, my career has this like very natural arc in which I just follow my passion and everything works out, right? Like that's not really true in practice. I would say that there have definitely been times where there has been a project where the ethos of it I was really into, where it would be like, we're trying to do this thing that's really cool. It's like a new media startup-y type thing where it's like, we're starting this thing. Will you help us start this thing? And it seems really cool. And all the people involved are really great. And then the kind of reality of journalism business stuff just like doesn't work. And it's really hard to start a new thing. And sometimes, you know, like the money doesn't end up appearing where you think there's going to be money. And, you know, I worked on a project where there was some miscommunications between the people who were supposed to be sort of like running the business side and the people who were me commissioning a lot of the editorial. And I wound up like paying some writers out of my own pocket because we had told them they'd be paid and the money didn't appear. And so like there are places where it didn't work, but I always learned something from it. And like, you know, I mean, this wasn't like thousands of dollars. It was like a couple of $250 stories for like, you know, online publications. But yeah, there have definitely been times when I got really excited about something and it didn't work out.
And is that always when it runs up against business considerations? Or like, have you also found that in your journalism? Like when you follow your interests and look for things that will be fun simply in the work, does that go belly up very often?
Sometimes. I mean, in the same way that like sometimes you think you have a story and then you start doing reporting and then you're like, oh, I don't have a story, right? Like, or it's like just more complicated than you thought it was going to be. I spent a year and a half chasing this story that I was really interested in, I thought was really worth telling, and I could not sell it anywhere. And it was one of those things where like I could see the story coming, but it hadn't quite happened yet. You know, when you have a story where you're like, this is about to be a thing, but then editors are like, okay, but like call me when it's a thing. And you're like, but you could, like, we could get, you know, like you could have it. And so, yeah, there have definitely been things I've sunk a lot of time into that didn't work out. But I think that's like part of journalism, like trying to pitch things and find stories, right?
Do those things like haunt you at all? Like the ones that you didn't get to?
All the time. Yeah. I think about it all the time.
Do you have like some file of the ones that got away?
Oh, yeah. I have a spreadsheet of every story I've ever pitched. And like what happened to it. And I sometimes go back and look through it and say like, okay, like should I pick this back up?
How many entries are on that spreadsheet now?
Oh, I could pull it up. Let's see.
While you're looking for it, what prompted you to start that thing?
I love spreadsheets. And let's see, pitches, here we are. Especially when I was first starting out, I was sending so many pitches out and it was like partially just to track like who have I pitched this idea and who said no and like who's my second choice and whatever. And then it just became a really satisfying marker of like stuff I'm doing. Like even if they don't all work out, just like, you know, when you feel like you have never had a good idea in your life and you'll never have a good idea again, it's like nice to be able to pull up the spreadsheet and be like, ah, no, I have in fact had scrolling 794 ideas. In my life, at the very least.
Minimum 794.
Minimum 794.
That's a powerful thing to do.
I love it. I love it. It's great. And then also, I will say, like, I have a little column that says, like, follow up in, and it'll say, like, a year or, like, 6 months or whatever. And so I can kind of, like, see if there's anything that kind of, like, got away at the time but is worth revisiting.
That's such a brilliant organizational structure when you yourself are your business. Do you have other tips like that? Are there other like things that you do to manage all of this?
Yeah, I actually have a freelancing spreadsheet that I made public for people to be able to borrow if they want it, because people ask me all the time, like, how do you keep track of everything and whatever? And so there's a Google Doc that I sometimes tweet out when, like, usually, sadly, when there's like a round of layoffs and I'm like, here's my thing if anyone wants to use it. But so yeah, I have a publicly available like spreadsheet that has multiple tabs about like how to keep track of your taxes and like how to keep track of your pitches and how to keep track of like the stuff you're working on and all that stuff. And that works for me.
That's like your legit, like you put together a how-to?
Mm-hmm.
Why?
People kept asking me, like, how do I freelance? And it would often be like friends who'd gotten laid off and they were like, I don't even know where to begin with some of this stuff. And I found that it wasn't that hard for me to just take the thing that I use and like empty out the cells and just put it on Google Docs and like make it public. I don't know. I feel like people were very generous with me when I first started out. And I mean, like I didn't know what a lead was, right? Like I needed a lot of handholding. And so people were very generous with me. And so I feel like there's no reason for me to like hoard information about freelancing. And so I might as well just like make it public.
Is that like hoarding mentality? Does that exist for freelancers? Do you think people are like competitive in that way? Don't want to give up the goods?
Definitely. And like there's if you want to pitch a magazine and you don't know how to reach one of the editors, if you ask another freelancer who's written for them, not all of them are willing to share that information about like literally just the email address like to pitch someone. And like on the one hand, I sort of understand that because if you are an editor, you're probably inundated with pitches. And if you don't know the person and that person might send a terrible pitch, like you don't want that to be connected to your name, right? Like so much of freelancing is relationship building between editors who trust you and like, you know, will answer your emails. But at the same time, like, I don't know. My method on that is just to ask the person if I don't know them, like, what's the pitch so that I can make sure that it would even be something that that person would want. But yeah, I think that there's a lot of freelancers still have like sort of a scarcity mentality, which makes sense, right? That like there is a limited number of spots in the Atlantic or whatever it is. And you kind of don't want to necessarily give up. Like maybe that person has a really good idea that's then going to like bump your idea off of the, you know, list or whatever it is. But I think more and more there is kind of like solidarity amongst freelancers, particularly as people have sort of realized that like employers in journalism like come and go, right? Like, you know, all we have is each other, right? And so I do think that there is more of a conversation about like being helpful than there used to be.
Was that part of why you gravitated towards eventually like starting your own thing? Was like just to be a little bit out of like the whims of the industry and the relationship building and just like having your work so dependent on an ecosystem over which you had very little control?
Honestly, I wish I could say that it was that. It was more that I was rejected by every podcast network that I pitched for Flash Forward.
No shit.
Yeah. So I tried, in fact, to sell Flash Forward to take it to Gimlet, take it to lots of places, Radiotopia, etc. And they all said no. So I did my own thing.
Tell me about that process. Like, how long did it take? When did you stop doing it? What were the reasons? How did you like scrape yourself off the like floor and make the thing anyway? Like, how did that go?
Yeah. Well, so I sent a lot of emails out just kind of being like, hey, I have this show. It had a first season.
This would have been like 2015, 2016.
Yeah. So the first season of Flash Forward was called Meanwhile in the Future. It was at Gizmodo. And so Annalie Newitz, who was there, they messaged me and were like, hey, we're thinking about starting a podcast. Do you have any ideas? I had sent them a list of ideas, Flash Forward being like the one that I was most excited about. They were like, yes, we love this. It was a good match for Gizmodo and IO9 because it was kind of like the fiction and journalism and sort of blending. We did a pilot run there. And then basically by the end of that, Annalie was gone. And then so I think it was like 3 weeks after the final episode, the Hulk Hogan situation happened. And so like I was just like totally lost in the weeds of like, or sort of like whatever. And so I took Flash Forward with me. But I was like, I don't know how to run a podcast. Like, what am I going to do? Do this by myself? Like, I didn't really know how that would work. And so, yeah, I emailed everybody that I could find emails for. I like met with people at Gimlet. I met with people at Radiotopia, all those places. And it was interesting. It was an interesting range of conversations. But all of them basically made it clear pretty quickly that like Flash Forward was not something that they were interested in for a lot of different reasons. It has always been a hard show to sell, both on ad sales and on like everything from awards to like these conversations around who would distribute it, because It's got fiction in it, which makes journalists uncomfortable. And it's got journalism in it, and so it's not really a fiction show. And so all the fiction networks were like, well, this isn't a fiction show, right? The fiction's only like 5 to 7 minutes of the podcast, right? And so it never quite like fits in people's boxes.
It's kind of amazing that like you were out pitching this show to these like journalist outfits, and you were like, it is part experimental fiction, but that has worked for me in this process previously.
Right, exactly. Right, exactly. Be like, listen, trust me. But no, yeah, they were not interested. And then also like there is an element of like being, and this is less true now, but like there weren't very many shows about science hosted by women. And I had one person tell me I didn't have host magic. I should find a famous person to host the show instead. So yeah, it was a range of conversations, but I don't know, like I am incredibly stubborn, and when I want to do something, I'm going to probably do it. So I was just like, all right, cool. I'll just do this myself.
I want to dig into that moment for a second, Rose, because I think that's rare. Like you go out, you pitch this thing, you get told all these different reasons, including like host magic, go find a famous person. And did it not cross your mind? Like, okay, this one's not the thing. Where does it come from to just be like, I'm gonna fucking figure it out how to do it anyway.
Yeah. I mean, I think it helped that I did have people who liked the show already. Like the show had 23 episodes and people were into it. And Anna Lee was into it. And people who I really respected were like, this is cool. You should keep doing it. I don't think I had a lot of illusions that it was like the best show ever made. I didn't really know how to use Pro Tools. I was like learning how to do all of this while making the show. I didn't know how to mix like fiction audio. Like I knew the show wasn't like this beautiful, perfect object that people were going to get in some bidding war to buy, right? But I also really genuinely believed like there was something there, and that there was like something worth pursuing, and that there was a value in the combination of fiction and journalism for things like the future and science and technology. And I like believed in it enough and had enough people who I really respected telling me like you should keep doing it, that like it wasn't like I was starting from zero and just pitching the idea. I did have a proof of concept, and I did have people who were really supportive, who I really thank like for keeping me going, like Ed Young, who would be like, no, you can't give up. Like you gotta keep going. And so it's not like it came out of just my own like ego or whatever, where I was like, this is a great idea.
You were getting like positive encouragement. It just wasn't coming from people who potentially could make it like financially viable for you.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. And I did come out of like a weird, like I didn't know anything about prestige podcast. Like I didn't know, like I didn't listen to Gimlet until I was like sort of pitching them stuff, because I was like, this is not the world I live in. Like the show didn't sound like that stuff. And so I get it. Like it doesn't fit. Like I heard that a lot. It doesn't really fit with what we do. And I'm like, yep, that's not incorrect. Right. Like that's true.
Yeah.
I can't fault you for that.
Has the use of fiction evolved over the course of the show?
Yeah, I think so. I've tried to experiment with it a lot because it's fun. But also, I think I've gotten a lot clearer about the function that it serves in the show. When I first started making the show, I didn't have like a grand unifying theory of why this was a good idea. And then over the years, I sort of have realized what the purpose of the fiction is in a much more like kind of theoretical, like what am I doing here kind of way. And so I've tailored it to actually serve that function, as opposed to just being like, ooh, that's fun. Like,
what does that look like? I mean, can you sort of help me understand how you make that call? Like when it should come in?
Yeah. So I think that the reason why fiction is good for a show like Flash Forward is a couple of them. The first one is that it's hard to report about the future because it has not happened yet. So like you can't go out and like gather tape about like what's going on. So you kind of have to create these scenes. But the real reason that I think that fiction is useful in this context is that often when people talk about the future, it can feel very vague and it can feel really hard to relate to, even around things that are specific like facial recognition or like privacy or whatever it is. You kind of know that those things exist, and you like kind of have a sense that like maybe that will be a certain way, but it's really hard to imagine how that actually relates to your day-to-day life in a lot of ways. And so giving people a scene to step into where they can do all the things you do in fiction, which is like, why did they do that? Would I have done the same thing? Like, what would my reaction be if I was in this world? And so when I think now about doing the fiction, rather than just like what would be a fun scene or like what would be an interesting thing, I think about like what are the problems that someone might encounter in the future? And how can I put the listener in that scene through a character so they have to kind of think through what they would do in kind of a more explicit way? And that's kind of like been the shift over the years for the fiction.
Is the fiction more challenging than the nonfiction parts of the show?
For some episodes, yes. And for some episodes, no. For some episodes, I'm like, oh, I know exactly what I want to do. Like, I have this image in my head of what that's going to be. And then for other episodes, it's harder to show things because you kind of like, it's sort of like silly, but like in the future, things don't make sounds as much as they make sounds in the past, right? When you're like dialing a phone, if you're like trying to make that an audio fiction, it's there's nothing to hear, right? Like it used to be like you would put the buttons and then it would ring.
Right.
And now even like if you get a phone call, your phone's probably like not going to make a sound. It just like lights up and you pick it up. And so like all those little things that you sonically would hear in like older audio fiction, you can't use in the future.
Yeah.
But even beyond that, like this is like the challenge of audio fiction, right? Like you have to kind of make it clear what's happening without having a character be like, and now I am logging into my account in which I will
right,
do this.
Right. You know, like. Why do the book? Like I imagine that agents have been calling you for years and being like, why don't you do a book? A book version could be cool. Blah, 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 blah. Like, why do it now? Because I assume you must have had options.
Yeah, people had been emailing me for a long time being like, you should do a book. You should do a book. And I just couldn't figure out what would be fun to do and that I would like want to read, honestly, as a listener. Like, I didn't want to just rewrite episodes, like take the transcripts from episodes and kind of like turn them into prose for a book. I was like, I wouldn't want to buy that if I were a listener. Like, I don't know. I just like wouldn't want to do that. It doesn't sound fun. And so I couldn't think of anything for a long time. I had an agent anyway, because I was sort of like thinking about other book projects and it would come up and people would ask and I would just be like, I just like, I could not think of it. And then Sophie Goldstein, who's a comic artist, was a listener of the show, emailed me and was like, hey, I love the show. Have you ever thought about doing like a comics thing, comic adaptation where we'd do like a comic and then you'd write something? And that was really where I was like, oh, that would be really cool. Like that actually sounds really fun. The idea of working with a bunch of comic artists sounds really fun. It feels like it is a reimagining of the show as opposed to just like a straight translation. I'd never done anything with like comics like that before, so that sounded fun. And so, yeah, it was 100% Sophie's idea. Like, I can take no credit for it. But that was the moment where I was like, oh, yeah, that's the way to do it. That feels like a way that's going to be fun and interesting for me.
And what was the process like trying to sell the book?
It was interesting. We put together a proposal. We went out to a lot of artists sort of saying like, hey, would you be interested generally in something like this? And then we took it out and it's a weird book. It's like half comics anthology, half essays. Like, you know, it's kind of this weird hybrid. And a lot of publishers were like, well, we'd like it if it was just text. Like, could you just write the fiction pieces? And I really wanted to have different artists for every chapter. And they were like, well, we really want one. We don't want to do something that has whatever.
Why was that important to you to have different artists?
I think I wanted to sort of show a variety of interpretations of these futures. Because every one of the intro scenes feels different, right? Like some of them are like gimmicky radio plays and some of them are more straight and some of them are musicals. And so like they are all kind of different and I wanted to preserve that kind of ethos in the book and kind of have the variety. And turns out comic anthologies are hard to sell. but Abrams actually like got it immediately and was like, yes, we really like this. They've published a lot of comic stuff already. And so once we met them, I was like, oh yeah, okay, that's who we should go with.
It is a different book. Like it feels different to read it. It took me a second literally just to like kind of grok what was going on, you know? Did it take you a second to figure out what the thing would be? Or did you guys have this relatively clear in your heads and it was just about like executing it?
I think it was relatively clear. You know, I talked to Matt and Sophie who were co-edited on the book with me, thankfully, because they both know about comics and I do not. I had to be like, what are the stages of like creating? Like I had no idea, again, like no clue how this would work. And they were very patient and lovely and made sure that the book like looks great. But yeah, I think from the very beginning, it was like, I knew I wanted every chapter to start with a comic. And then I leaned on Matt and Sophie to be like, how many pages is like going to be doable for artists but also enticing and feel like enough pages to like really get into it, right? Because like we could have done, and some of the people we talked to, some of the publishers wanted like a 2-page comic and then mostly the essay, And I really wanted it to be able to like get into the characters. Not that you can't do that in two pages, but to give them a little more breathing room. And so we gave every artist an option for like a page range, right? Like they didn't have to do like 16 or whatever. Most of them actually ended up opting to like go almost the full length, if not the full length of the 16, to kind of get into it. But once Sophie pitched it and I got it in my head, I was like, I was pretty clear on like what I wanted.
Well, it's a feat. The book feels like a feat to me. I'm interested in how you make choices with the work too, because the bucket you have set up for yourself, which feels to me like one of the more sort of like brilliant conceits for a show that exists out there, because you could make the show for the rest of time.
Yeah.
Right? There are infinite futures.
Yeah.
I mean, is that daunting to you, the fact that like this can conceivably never end? Like, is that exciting?
Yeah, neither. It's like, I think about this a lot, actually, because there was a period of time about 2.5 years ago when things were like not going well for the show. Listeners were way down. My ad sales company like sold zero ads on an entire year of the show. And I was like, okay, is this the end of the road for Flash Forward? Right. Like, and I do believe that like not everything needs to go on forever. Not every project has to be like an infinity project. And so like I was trying to kind of think through like, how will I know when Flash Forward is done? Like, how will I know to end something? It's hard, right? Like, and I think a lot of shows go through this, right? Where they like change hosts. I mean, I, you know, don't have the same kind of like golden handcuffs as some of the big shows that like have to kind of keep going because they have whole staffs to like, you know, keep employed and whatever. But, you know, I wanted to think through like, how will I know that it's time to be like, that was a good run, move on to other projects. And I don't know that I have like a really great answer for that still, but the thing I was thinking about was like, do I feel like I'm still learning things? Not just like content wise, but also learning about what I'm interested in, how to make the show and sort of about fiction or reporting or whatever it is. And do I feel like the show is providing something to the audience that like has a function that isn't being filled elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And when those two things no longer are true, when I feel like I'm just sort of going through the motions and doing the same thing and not learning anything, and also that like maybe they can get the same kind of stuff elsewhere, that'll probably be when I decide it's time to be done. But the actual number of like possible episodes is very freeing, because I don't feel like, oh God. I mean, I do sometimes feel like, oh God, what are we going to do? Like, what are the next set of episodes? But like, it never feels like that we're ever going to run into some sort of like natural limit that like you've interviewed all the people you can interview, like, you know, about this thing.
Right. I mean, it's interesting that you're kind of like, when am I going to stop learning? Because I feel like it is so broad in a way, like it's essentially just like a sort of blank canvas for your own curiosity.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And it can go anywhere, right? Like I can be like, I want to make a mini season about this topic in the future. Right? Like, it literally could be anything.
Like, you know, there's an episode recently, which is also in the book, about smart cities, which feels to me like a super straightforward version of the show.
Mm-hmm.
It has this amazing thing at the top about, like, you know, sentient park benches. And, like, I listened to it walking through the park, was looking at a bench, was just like, holy shit, that is actually, like, that could happen. That could happen kind of soon. Like, part of what I'm interested in is, like, how much of this is driven by things you're trying to figure out in 2021 rather than helping other people figure out in the future?
I think the secret to any and all science fiction is that it's always about the present, right? Like that's sort of true of any sci-fi that you ever read, is that that's like people trying to figure out how to live now versus, you know, moon colonies, right? Like Ursula K. Le Guin's books are not about going to the moon, right? Like that's not what they're about. So yeah, a lot of them are, not all of them. I think some of them are, I think about the episodes in two big buckets. One of them is like weird shit I'm interested in, where I'm like, I want to learn about like we did an episode recently about what would it be like if you could be like immune to all poison, venom, like everything.
Yeah.
And that just literally came out of because I got a press release about like snakes that use like magnetic techniques to like attract and repel other snakes' venom inside their bodies. And I was like, that's fucking awesome, right? Like that's really cool and interesting. And then I kind of fell down a rabbit hole of like, yeah, like how does venom work, and learned a ton of stuff about it. And so like things that I just find like cool and weird and interesting. So that's like one bucket. And the other one is like things I'm trying to figure out, like how do you make a better future? How should we be? How are we supposed to think about these things? Like, should I care about blank or do I not actually need to care about that? Because there's so many things to get freaked out about, I think, in the news and stuff. And so like part of it is me being like, okay, on a scale of 1 to 10, like how much should I worry about Starlink, right? Like, is that like a thing I should be thinking about all the time or a thing I should only be thinking about right. like once a month or whatever it is?
Is that a 2 or a 9?
Yeah, exactly. And so some of it is that, and also just like trying to think through what is a good solution. I don't put a lot of stock in the idea that like you can't critique things if you don't have a solution, because like I think that's bullshit. But like some of what I think about is, okay, if I know that I don't want that future, like what would it actually look like to not have that? Like how do you avoid it? The sort of questions of what could I do now that might help are things I think a lot about and sort of use the show in some ways to like work through.
Are there examples of that? I mean, are there things that you can draw a direct line between work you've done on the show and something that's changed, whether it's about you or the way you live or in your life? Like one of the things you learn doing these interviews for years and years and years is that people are kind of like always writing about themselves on some level, even like war correspondents, you know, they're trying to figure something out themselves. And listening to the show, I have wondered over the years whether like there's stuff that you're really working out and whether it's impacting your life now.
Yeah, the most obvious example, I think, is I am sort of like obsessed with the way that humans and animals interact and like why we think the things we do about animals. It's sort of a running joke among Flash Forward listeners now because they know that like there's always going to be some like weird animal thing, because I'm like, why is it that we think about facial recognition in people a lot, but then we just use it on animals? Like, that's no problem. Like, is that a thing we should be worried about? And people are like, why? Like, that's a ridiculous question. But I don't think it's a ridiculous question. So I think probably the most obvious example is I did an episode about animal testing and sort of the future of animal testing, because I was like, I don't actually totally understand this. And like, I don't understand what is necessary, what is not necessary. Like, how should I be thinking about this? You know, all of that. But we do a lot of animal related episodes because I am just like, I mean, I have a pet dog. And I do think a lot about like, how weird it is that humans have domesticated animal. Like, it's just weird when you start thinking about like, there's this creature that I like has agency, has some sort of internal life, right? Like whatever it is. And I like put it on a leash and I walk it around and it's just like weird, you know, like, and just thinking through like, how much do they understand about the world? And if we really knew how animals think, would we do the things that we do to them? I don't know. Just like, that's a big one that I'm like constantly trying to figure out in my own life. And then therefore on the show, it's like animals as a category.
Is that curiosity that you're talking about? Is that diminishing or growing for you?
You mean about animals specifically or in
no,
general?
No, I mean in general, like, you're like on the like the Rose curiosity meter. Like, are we up right now or are we down?
I would say I think we're up right now. In the curiosity index is rising. In part because I'm wrapping a project that I'm working on, and so I'm now like kind of able to start like thinking about other things. You know, when you're like deep in on production on something and you're like, the only thing I can think about right now is like this set of episodes that I'm working on. And so now that I'm out of it or almost out of it, I do feel like now I'm like, oh yeah, what about that? Like, what if I looked really deeply into like that thing? I'm learning a lot about fungus right now. Very interested in fungus as like a category.
What's going on with you, fungus?
Yeah. Did you know, I learned this recently, that fungus is more closely related to us than to plants? Like, didn't know that.
I did not know that.
Yeah. So there's a reason why it's actually very hard to kill fungus, fungal infections in humans, is because most of the things that kill fungus also kills us. And so it is very challenging to treat those infections.
Huh.
You should stop me because I will start rattling off more fungus facts. And I don't know that that's the good use of our time.
I'm not sure we need to spend too much time on fungus facts, but you know, if we can do a bonus episode that's just straight fungus facts. I think part of the reason I ask that question about curiosity is I've listened to the show for a long time. I've read a lot of stuff that you've written, but also I try not to look at Twitter very much. But sometimes when I do look at it, you're expressing very strong opinions about the industry in which you work. And I would categorize them as displeased.
Yeah, I think that's fair to
like,
say.
Like, my sense is that your time since submitting experimental fiction in a science journalism grad program at NYU has been that, like, the industry writ large, the business concerns in journalism, the things that you have come up against that are not about the work have been unpleasant. Does that seem accurate to you?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, like, I think a lot about the fact that, like, I am incredibly, like, lucky and privileged to be able to succeed and, like, make it work. And that's in part because, like, I don't have student debt, right? Like, I don't have some of these other things. And I think a lot about how many people wouldn't be, like, just don't have the tools and opportunities to be able to do the kind of thing that I do. And I think that's, like, a huge loss for the industry. And it doesn't seem to be getting better. The doors are not necessarily opening for those folks more than they were when I was starting out.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. I wouldn't dispute that at all. And I guess I was wondering whether there is a connection between that frustration and seeing these patterns happen again and again and again, and like the Rose Eveleth Curiosity Index. Mm.
I think that if I didn't have that pretty bizarrely insatiable drive to do this stuff and like understand things and that curiosity, I don't know that I would still be doing this, right? Like, I think that like the curiosity index has to be high in order to make the rest of it worth it.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, like, what's the point? Like, otherwise, like, I should go get a real job, you know? And I mean, like, I will be totally honest, like, especially early on in the pandemic, I was like, I should just go become an EMT. Like, I make a weird show about the future. Like, am I doing anything that anyone needs? You know, like, I don't know. Why am I fighting so hard for this industry that, like, will never love me back and also is maybe not even doing that much to, like, help educate people about the importance of vaccines and like, you know, like, I have, like, a full-on spiral, right? And so I think there are definitely days where I'm like, yeah, why am I doing this? Like, why? Like, what makes it worth it? And I don't always have a good answer. Some days I don't have a good answer. Some days that balance, like that math doesn't work out. But I do think that when I'm actually doing the work and I'm actually working with the people who I like working with, and when I'm, you know, in it, making the shows and interviewing people and getting to come up with weird fictional scenes and like commissioning musicians to make me a sitcom song about living underground, like I have to focus on that because there's a reason why I care a lot and I want other people to be able to like do all this weird shit that I do. Right. And so like, it has to feel rewarding in order to make the rest of it feel worth it.
I feel like this must be a question you get all the time, but, what are the like possible and not so possible futures for you? Like what,
yeah.
What do you want to do next? Where's all this going for you?
My possible and not so possible actually feels like both. It is both possible and not so possible future. I would like to write a fiction book. I would like to write a science fiction book. You know, every morning I do my morning pages and I write a little bit of my book and I have 30,000 words.
That's awesome.
So yes, I would love to do that. That's a big goal of mine, is to at least like, even if it never sees the light of day, which like is probably the more likely outcome, to just like have it, like finish it and say like, okay, that was like, see if that's the thing I want to do. So that's my big one right now that I'm thinking a lot about.
That and fungus.
Well, they're related.
It's a science fiction book about fungus?
Yes.
Yes! thank you so much for doing this. It was such a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you for having me. This is fun. Thanks for putting up with all my fungal facts.
Okay, listen, I'm here for the fungal facts,
good,
always.
Good.
I'll be there for the book, too.
Exciting. Yeah, well, we'll see. It may be shelved in a drawer forever, but at least it will be a thing that I can say, like, I tried that.
Well, if nothing else, you can submit it for some sort of grad program.
Right, when I go back to grad school. For science, though, this time.
So yeah, right.
Just keep it going.
Yeah, for med school.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you, Rose.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Longform. I'm Max Linsky. My co-hosts are Aaron Lammer and Evan Ratliff. Our editor this week was Gabriela Saldivia.
Gabriella, such a pleasure to be working with you. And our intern is Julianne Sato Parker. Thanks to them. Thanks to our sponsors, MailChimp, for making this show possible. And thanks so much to Rose. Her tips for freelancers are in the show notes. Go check them out. The show is Flash Forward. The book is by the same name. See you next week.
Support for this show comes from Art, Beats, and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art, Beats, and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual paths while also revealing their distinct roles within Art, Beats, and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Why do you run? Why does anyone?
I always thought that runners loved running, and that's not the case. Most runners hate running, but they choose to do it.
In the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk, Abby Ayers learns why women runners everywhere are driven to go the distance.
It really is about taking my power back and proving myself wrong.
Team Milk is about fueling women's performance and helping them along their marathon journeys. You can sign up now for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon taking place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16th, 2024. Learn more and register at everywomansmarathon.com.